If you're not familiar with Etsy, we're an online marketplace for vintage goods, handmade goods, and arts and crafts materials. So I was going to put in some visual gag about signature jewelry, sewing patterns, and fashion trends, but I couldn't make it work, so just pretend I did that. So I'm going to start off with a little story. The clock's not running, by the way, so I assume I can go on. Hey, thanks. I'm going to start off with a little story about a package called Kale, which was developed a couple of years ago as a collaboration between our data engineering team and our ops team. And the idea of Kale was to build something that watches the graphs so that you don't have to. So it would ingest metrics from our data centers, from software, hardware, application level metrics, coming from things like graphite or ganglia. Then it had two components that they were fed through. One was called Skyline. It was for anomaly detection. So noticing unusual behavior in graphs with a little bit more sophistication than something like Nagios with fixed thresholds will allow. And the second stage was called Oculus, and that was more for diagnostic or investigative purposes. So if you found an anomaly via Skyline, you could ask Oculus which other metrics are behaving like this. What is showing a similar pattern in its graphs, or what has historically shown a similar pattern to this thing that's just gone, you know, haywire? It had quite a few constraints and requirements. So it had to work on, at the time, around about 250,000 metrics coming in parallel, each with a sampling interval of either 10 seconds or 60 seconds, depending on where they came from. It had to work quickly enough to be useful in responding to or managing an incident. So we're talking no like overnight batch jobs for processing the data, no Hadoop, that kind of thing. Not like real time in the sense that, you know, an avionics manufacturer or a high-frequency trader might mean real time, but certainly not batch. And it had to work kind of out of the box without having to configure something potentially individually for 250,000 different data streams. Right, so that all sounds kind of difficult. Well, that's sarcasm, by the way. Yes, it did turn out to be quite difficult, more difficult than anyone at the time anticipated. So although we launched it with a fair bit of song and dance, nice user interface, installation packages, all of that kind of thing, a couple of conference talks, fast forward 2 years, we're not actually using it internally anymore. I'm not really aware of anybody using it apart from experimentally outside of Etsy either. But it's still an unsolved problem. And we've got about four times as many metrics coming in now, about a million metrics coming in parallel. And we don't really have a working solution for keeping track of what's going wrong with them, because just watching that many graphs doesn't scale. It's not just us that has this problem. So Twitter and Netflix have both recently released packages for anomaly detection, targeting slightly different use cases to us. Yahoo have very recently released a data set of server metric data that's annotated with the anomalies that it contains, plus another set of synthetic data with anomalies injected into it in order to benchmark tools like this against. So it's not just us that's thinking about this, but we didn't manage to make it work the first time we tried to approach this problem. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what went wrong, why that didn't work, and why as an open source project that was a bit of a failure. And then we're going to talk a little bit about what we're doing differently this time. And then, because I'm foolhardy and I've already had one failure, I'm going to try a live demo. So let's see how that goes. So first off, what worked well with Kale 1.0? So the time series similarity search component, Oculus, that computationally, that's quite a hard job, especially over that many time series. But we actually got that working reasonably well. So that works in kind of two stages. First off, you fingerprint the data using this really nice hack called a shape description alphabet, and I'll explain that in a second. And via those fingerprints, that lets you get an approximate set of candidate results for a query quite quickly. So by query, I mean, here's this time series with an anomaly in it. I want to quickly get back a subset of all of the possible matches. I can then use a more costly exact ranking method to find the ones that match most closely. So the exact ranking method is called dynamic time warping. I'm not going to go into that. You can go and look that up if you're interested. But it's a way of matching up time series data that accounts for things like compression and stretching and things being out of phase with each other. But this is just a really nice hack. The way you fingerprint the data to get the first candidate set back is you basically map the line segments between adjacent points in that time series to tokens, i.e. just letters, based on their gradient. So typically you use five, like steep upwards, shallow upwards, roughly level, shallow downwards, and steep downwards. That gives you a string of letters that represent a time series. Then you index those with a Lucene-based indexer, like Elasticsearch in our case. And then you can use a sloppy phrase query with your query sequence containing the anomaly as your query string. And you can say, I want an adjustable level of slop, which determines how many kind of insertions and deletions you're allowed between matching subsets of letters. And that will really quickly, because you know search engines are fast at that kind of thing, give you back a load of similar-ish sequences that you can then search with dynamic time warping to get closeness to the query sequence. That worked pretty well. I haven't found an obviously better way of doing that, so I'm going to carry this stuff over into the new version, fed pretty much as is. What proved hard? Okay, so there are a couple of things that I would say it's fair to say that more things proved difficult than easy, which is why we're moving on from the original approach. So first off, the architecture contained a lot of complexity. There's a lot of moving parts there. Roughly speaking, the stuff on the left is the ingestion part, the top left, and then Skyline, which is the anomaly detection part. And the part on the right is Oculus, which is the similarity search part. Now, you can see all of these decisions, I can see why they made sense at the time for one reason or another, but looking back, less so sometimes. So we've got two data storage engines in there, effectively, Redis and Elasticsearch. We've got two web serving frameworks, Flask and Sinatra. One of them's in Python, one of them's in Ruby, right? We've got, as well as Python and Ruby custom code, we've got Java code in Elasticsearch to do the time series matching. We've got JavaScript code in the two front ends, which are entirely separate web applications for the two halves of it. We've got a queuing mechanism, Rescue, built on top of Redis. Then we've also got lots of kind of custom connectors in both Ruby and Python that aren't really kind of surfaced on the diagram for plugging the parts together. So it's a lot of different things to maintain and support. It's a lot of things to get installed, even with the help of like Chef and Puppet recipes. And it puts you at risk if you build an open source project like this of you end up having to support all of those things, because if somebody has a problem getting two or three parts to work together, they're not necessarily going to know which of those parts the problem is or which config file to look in for the problem. Often they're going to be on separate machines. You might have unreliable network connections. You might have mistakes setting the ports right, firewalls, that kind of thing. Also, you're not necessarily going to be dealing with people that have got Python and Ruby and Java and JavaScript skills in-house to help debug things themselves. So especially if you end up not using it in production yourself, that's quite a lot of support load to expose yourself to. I can't think of any open source projects with this many disparate components that have been made into a success. Now, you might say Hadoop, that's got loads of components, but they were all made to work together from the ground up. They're all designed to be parts of the Hadoop ecosystem. These are all third-party things that we tried to glue together, and it didn't work so well. And then the anomaly detection part of it, which I'm going to dwell on a little bit more because I think that's where I can make the biggest difference. That turned out to be quite tricky as well to get right. So the algorithms that the original developers of KAOL concentrated on kind of came from mostly from sort of statistics textbooks that were, if you go back far enough, based on things like industrial process control, where you're looking at kind of making sure that the physical widgets that are coming out of a production line, for example, are within acceptable tolerances from each other, right? But they make a lot of assumptions about the data that often don't hold true when you're looking at machine data. So they tend to assume that the data is either it's either stationary, as in it's got a flat baseline, or it's got a kind of predictable trend. If they take into account cycles, they tend to be sort of seasonal variation on the human scale, like daily, weekly, or monthly cycles, which are themselves of a regular length that don't get shorter or longer or superimposed on each other in weird ways. They tend to assume the data is normally distributed, i.e. it follows a nice bell curve if you do a histogram of it, whereas a lot of machine data is actually like this kind of charming bit of cross-stitch where you've got one distribution with another one superimposed on it. Or sometimes you've got something that follows a power law, which is, you know, where you've got kind of an exponential decay curve like that. And a lot of statistical functions have trouble with those. A lot of machine data is very kind of naturally spiky. So if you don't do any smoothing on it, you can get like actually perfectly natural spikes that will look like anomalies, particularly if they happen to occur at the top of a periodic cycle like that. Those cycles can kind of come and go because they might be the result of garbage collectors or cron jobs or something like that, depending on what you're measuring. And also, if you've got that many metrics, inevitably you're going to get lots of false alarms, right? So normally with a statistical significance test, you have kind of a threshold for how many false alarms I'm going to tolerate. Like, I would expect maybe 1 in a million positive results from this test to be actually a false positive. Now, that's great in most cases, but if you've got 250,000 metrics, and we're actually up to around 1 million now, if you've got 1 million metrics and you're measuring them all every minute, you'd expect one false positive every minute, even if you've got a 1 in a million cutoff, right? So you've got to come up with ways of dealing with that. There were a couple of things that they put in to mitigate this. So majority voting of different statistical methods. Like, if you've got 5 statistical tests and 3 of them say that chunk of data looks anomalous, then it's a majority, so you raise an alarm. But if only 2 of them say it, you ignore it. Auto-silencing as well. If one of them keeps going off, it will then silence itself until a period of non-anomalous data has reset it, which is a pretty good idea. One of the problems with the majority voting approach is that if you've got a lot of tests that kind of measure the same thing, like how far away the latest value is from some mean or median looking at some recent window, if they're all doing that but in slightly different ways, then they tend to get false positives together. So that removes some of the advantage of majority voting. But there are other more fundamental problems, I think, that a lot of talks on anomaly detection don't cover, which is that not every anomaly in machine data is a point outlier. So by point outlier, I mean like one of these 2 huge spikes, which is like way out from just looking at that graph, you can kind of go, there are 2 big spikes there, unless there are any that are obscured by these lines in the display, but let's not worry about those. So most anomaly detection talks and blog posts and a lot of the tools that you can get are really just outlier detection. But there are, as I'll go through a few other examples of other kinds of anomalies that could indicate that there are problems with the machine. But also it's worth noticing that not every point outlier is still an anomaly if you step back and look at more data, right? So it looks like there's 2 huge spikes in that, right? But maybe this is an hour's worth of data and we step back and look at a day's worth, maybe they happen, you know, a couple of times an hour anyway, so actually they're business as usual. Maybe if you happen to be looking on a smaller time scale and you're zoomed in on this bit here, you'd go, holy crap, there's an anomaly in the middle there. But actually you look at, you know, 1,024 data points and it does that all the time anyway. So you've got to take into account a lot of context, and then there's trade-offs between how much context you take into account and how much memory you're using, how much CPU time you're using, and so on. So there's a few other kinds of things that are worth mentioning. So like periodic oscillations can kind of suddenly appear. By the way, these are all genuine error logs, error streams of various kinds of errors from our web servers. It doesn't matter which kinds they are. I can't even remember. But they're all illustrative of different kinds of behavioral changes that might be a sign of trouble. So periodic oscillations can disappear, or they can suddenly change in frequency, or they can appear out of nowhere. trends can change. Like, we've got kind of a general upward trend here, but the baseline kind of suddenly jumps. The trend's going in the same direction, but it jumps up and then jumps back down again. Maybe in some cases that kind of thing's a sign of a problem. Maybe in this one, actually, if you look at the start of the graph, it sort of starts off doing that. So maybe if you step back and look across a whole day, it's just a slightly wiggly trend that does that anyway. Sometimes a flat line with some variation can suddenly start to dive, or sometimes something that should have a constant growth rate actually levels off and flatlines. And, you know, if that's number of purchases or something, then you've got trouble, right? And then rare discrete events, like sometimes what you're actually measuring is individual instances of things happening, you know, less than once per sampling period, then sometimes they can suddenly become a lot more frequent or a lot more infrequent. So these can all be signs that something are going wrong that an outlier detection algorithm won't actually pick up. The best bit is, right, it's usually not even a problem. Like I said, if you step back and look at more data, those kind of things just occur, right? I think particularly point outliers, if everything goes back to normal after a sudden spike, then there's a good chance that actually that was some kind of a glitch that really hasn't thrown anything off. Particularly if it's a dip, if it's a dropout for the, you know, one single sampling period, chances are that's actually just a problem with your data collection pipeline, right? Maybe you just didn't get the, maybe graphite didn't receive the appropriate thing from the machines at that point. So what are we doing about this? Well, I've been looking at different ways to approach this problem. I think part of the reason that progress is quite slow is that there aren't kind of engineer-friendly ways of experimenting with different kinds of pre-processing, smoothing, filtering mechanisms, different statistical tests with convenient common interfaces, that kind of thing. Most of the tools exist out there for free, but they're in languages like MATLAB and R, and if you're lucky, Python with NumPy, and they're targeted more at scientists and engineers and mathematicians and statisticians than they are at developers, engineers, and so on. So I've been building up a library of kind of composable operators that you can chain together into like signal processing pipelines. It's called TIME. I'm hoping to release it open source as a library aimed at developers that want to bring this kind of functionality into their own applications within the next month or two. At the moment, I'm working on finishing off a decent tutorial for it, and I've just put the finishing touches to a demo app for it as well. It uses the ReactiveX framework, which is a kind of design pattern. It's a design pattern come library, which is for composing modular units on top of each other into kind of pipelines or chains. A little bit like something like, if any of you are familiar with like the Storm framework for doing real-time computing on clusters, a bit like that, but inside one process, right? So you've got a program which consists of these little modules chained together like Lego. That lets you do things like this and kind of experiment with different ways of approaching different kinds of data and looking for different kinds of anomalies. So you might, these are all kind of individual time components that you can glom onto each other with one line of code each. So you might get raw data coming in, split it into blocks, and then apply a wavelet filter, which lets you split out the high frequency components, like the noise and the roughness, from the low frequencies, so the changes in baseline and the kind of periodic oscillations. And then you might apply in parallel, you know, a block sorting algorithm and a windowing algorithm to each of those. And then at the end, you might find that on the data that you've got, because everyone's data sources are kind of different, you might want to apply an outlier detection algorithm to the high frequency data and an algorithm for detecting changes of distribution to the low frequency data, and then alert if either one of those or both of those goes off. And what I'm hoping to do with time is make it really easy to compose those pipelines. The idea is that we'll probably wrap these in Elasticsearch wrappers at some point, because we use the Elk stack for a lot of kind of logging and metric gathering work. And a lot of this stuff you could do in Logstash filters. So you would do pre-processing on the way in and then store pre-processed data, like, you know, split it into high frequency and low frequency data and store that separately. And then other parts of it you could do at query time as Elasticsearch aggregations. For example, you know, find me the 10 most anomalous looking blocks in the last 10 minutes, or bucket a set of subsequences by similarity to this one, that kind of thing. And then later on, we've also got a machine learning package called Conjecture, which is for doing machine learning in Scala on Hadoop. And a lot of these things, I think, would fit quite nicely into Conjecture functions. So you could use them. If your use case can tolerate some more latency, and you're looking at doing like longer-term analytics in batch mode, then that would be quite a good place to do it, because then the sky's the limit as far as how much data you can consider. So that's that, and like I said, I'm a bit foolhardy, so I'm going to actually do a quick live demo of time. So this is the demo app. Now what it's doing, in lieu of data from a server, it's actually listening to the microphone on my laptop. And the trace on there is showing, basically it's taking a volume reading every few milliseconds, averaging that out. If you're an audio geek, it's the RMS volume that it's plotting. And there's 512 in each block. So I've got that fed into a fairly simple time pipeline, which is kind of in the background here. There's probably not enough time to actually describe how that works, but it takes about one line of code to attach each of the filtering or processing components onto it. So as I talk, it's building up a library of blocks in order. And it hasn't produced any output yet, but that's because what it does is it gathers up enough context so that it can compare new blocks to what it's seen before that. Now, any minute now, it should start printing numbers in the output at the bottom of the screen. I think we've had probably about 8 blocks so far. Oh, I should also say it's using wavelet filtering, and it's only using the highest frequency bands from the data. So that's why it's centered around 0 with negative as well as positive results. So I've never done it in an auditorium with echoes and things before, so I don't know whether this is going to work as well as normal. But you can see those are all kind of positive values, kind of 0.1, 0.2 or thereabouts, because it's looking at previous stuff. And basically, these are p-values, which means the higher the value, the more similar it is to something it's seen already. Now, if I do something unexpected, like I shut up for a minute, now it's gone whoop, whoop, because it's detected that something unusual has happened there and that it doesn't have a block in its recent history that corresponds to that. And I went over a boundary, so it's got 2. But now I've started talking again, it should go back to normal. But similarly, if I superimpose some noise that it hasn't heard before, like if I start clapping in front of my laptop like that, then it should hopefully show some spikes that are also anomalous. Now, I think because I was talking in the background, it's got quite a low reading for those, but they're not showing as anomalies because of where the threshold's set. But if I shut up and give it some spikes, whoop, whoop, there we go, yeah. So, yeah. You'll be pleased to know that a room full of applause got 0.0, which is as anomalous as it can possibly get. So, certainly, I don't know, that maybe that's a metaphor for life. So that kind of works quite well, I think. But that's only on one sort of data, but it only took about 2-3 hours to write this demo app, and most of that was getting the graphing right and getting the microphone bits right. Putting the data processing pipelines together is like literally kind of, you know, it's a line of code to read from the microphone. There's some stuff to block individual readings into blocks, and then this is applying the wavelet filter, which just keeps the highest 3 frequency bands. It's kind of like a wavelet's like a, think of it like a graphic equalizer that lets you turn individual bands on or off, sort of. So different statistical tests work better on different frequencies, I've found. I think it's quite a powerful way of pre-processing the data, so you've got less noise between you and the signal of interest, basically. If you keep an eye on our tech blog, Coders Craft, or we're also Coders Craft on Twitter, we'll definitely post about it when we've got something out there that we can share. So yeah, just to recap, some lessons learned from KL 1.0. Keep your architecture simple, especially if you're planning to do an open source release. It's quite tempting to go, this component is a really good fit for our problem on paper. It maps really well onto our problem space. But that doesn't always imply, let's add this new piece to our stack immediately, because there are kind of operational overheads of installing it and supporting it. Even if it's not like front-end production code, if it's stuff you're using in production to monitor production code, that's still important. And it's particularly important if you expect like people on mailing lists to go, hey, hang on, I couldn't get my Elasticsearch to talk to my Redis. Well, you know, it's kind of your fault for having Elasticsearch and Redis and trying to make them talk to each other. Don't release a platform or all-in-one product unless you've got a good history of using it yourself, because you might end up with like something orphaned that you're not really getting any value from but people expect you to support. Anomaly detection is more than just outlier detection, so you need to think a little bit more carefully about different ways to process different kinds of data. A one-size-fits-all approach to that kind of thing is not likely to work. But you know, there's some things that KL1 was good at. It had a good user interface. It had a nice workflow. It looked very polished. I think that might have made it a victim of its own success a bit, because everyone went, ooh, shiny, that looks cool, let's play with that. So yeah, make sure your UI doesn't write checks that your algorithms can't cache. Ensemble methods and auto-calibration, a good idea for kind of managing the trade-off between sensitivity and false positives. So I'm putting stuff, you know, easy to use components in time to let you do that without lots of extra work. And it is feasible, after all, to do time series similarity search if you use kind of a rough approximate fingerprinting method first to narrow down your search space. So that's definitely going into time as well. That was one of the success stories. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
So you talked a lot about anomaly detection. And the problem is that problems and anomalies are not the same thing. So I'm wondering, even if you could do anomaly detection in a reliable way, how did that translate to problem detection?
So I think the next logical stage of this is not looking at metrics in isolation, but looking at patterns of behavior across multiple metrics. Potentially across like the same metric across all of your web servers, or a bunch of different metrics on one web server, for example. So things that you would expect to, if something was going properly wrong, I think you'd be likely to see more knock-on effects on other time series rather than just the one that originally alerted you, right? Because if it hasn't affected anything else, then you're right, it probably is just a statistical anomaly rather than a genuine problem. But if you've got, you know, some disk is running slow, then that's affecting page load times, and that's having a knock-on effect on bounce rate because people are going, the site's really slow today, I can't be bothered, then you've got an actual problem, right? So I think looking at those higher level groupings of correlated metrics is probably the way to go with that. But yeah, that's kind of the next step down the line.
Okay, just behind you.
Thank you. So the idea of mapping gradient patterns in the graph to alphabets, that's a fascinating approach. I was wondering if you also store the negations of each gradients in the time series, because you may have errors match up, line up nicely with the spikes, but if you have a graph of successes, then it's exactly the inverse of error graph, right?
Yeah, that's a very good point. We didn't do that in Oculus, in the original KL1, but that's certainly something we could put in without any extra hassle. That's a good point.
Okay, right at the back.
That was one of the most impressive demos that I've seen live. First of all, so congratulations. Secondly, obviously a primary use case of this is along with tools like Graphite, InfluxDB, OpenTSB, TSDB, will the integration when you open source it be a part of that open sourcing process, or is it something we're going to have to build when we decide to use it, for example?
So we don't really have the capacity to build integrations for tools that we're not using. I'm happy to kind of give people guidance if they want to work on something like that themselves. But something like OpenTSDB, for example, you could run these as like HBase coprocessors or something, but we're not going to do that for you because we don't run HBase, we don't run OpenTSDB, so that'd be a lot of extra work. But I'm hoping that the docs and following the examples from things that we do release to, you know, wire it into things that we do use would be enough to get people going. And I'm hoping to like make a better sort of like ground up community around this, so get people involved that are happy to experiment and got some time, hopefully from their employers going, yeah, that'd be really useful if we plug this in over here, that kind of thing.
Okay, one last question maybe.
I've had a couple of attempts to try and do some stuff with this. I was one of your Skyline experimenters.
Oh, well done. Thank you.
Yeah, well, it was an interesting learning exercise. I've also tried it with a anomaly detection as a service provider, which also didn't work out, but as neither of them worked out. They were useful, but didn't actually give us an awful lot in production. Mm. The biggest problem was the kind of learning and training the thing, because Skyline didn't really do that. Mm. And trying to effectively train somebody else's application also we found didn't really work out terribly well. We were looking at, again, million odd metrics per minute with that sort of weirdly jagged, noisy set of values. And it became very, very difficult to tell something funky in your metrics versus actual problem. One of the things we didn't look at, actually, which the next time I try and do this is probably worth considering, is, you know, looking at sets of behavior across many, many, many metrics rather than just looking at them in isolation. Mm. But, you know, given the how much data we're collecting these days, and the number of different things to look at, it's becoming harder and harder to do this usefully without looking at some gross abstraction of state and hoping that actually catches all your cases. But the, you know, what really made this a much tougher thing to put into production as a useful kind of issue spotter was, you know, filtering out the meaningless anomalies from the actual problems. I'm kind of interested to see what you guys come up with next.
Yeah, I'm interested as well. I'm not sure that was exactly a question, but thank you for your curiosity. And if you've got any like concrete ideas for particular things that we could try or not try, then I'm around for the whole rest of the day. Come and talk to me later.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Andrew, thank you so much.
Cheers.